Welcome to For the Love of Weather. This is the podcast where we explore the Earth's atmosphere and how we are all connected through the weather and climate. We are your hosts. Hi, I'm Gemma.
Hi, and I'm Ashling, and we're both meteorologists and weather presenters, and we just love chatting about the weather and climate. And we hope you enjoy this episode and leave this podcast just loving and learning a little bit more about the weather and climate and how it can impact your daily lives. We are so pleased to welcome Dr. Ruth Swetnam, who is a carbon and research manager for the Atlantic Rainforest Program at the Wildlife Trust, to the podcast. Ruth is a chartered geographer. How cool is that? And landscape specialist with a particular expertise in digital mapping. I did something on this at one point in a former life as well. Environmental science and landscape ecology. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ruth. I feel we always start our podcast by asking, where did your first spark of joy come from that you thought, oh, somehow this is going to become a career? But I'm literally listing all of these things that are bringing lots of sparks of joy. Where do we start? Where did it all start?
Well, I am a geographer, definitely, through and through. I originally wanted to be a forester, which didn't happen. I mean, I'm 5 foot four and about, I'm quite lightly built, so it didn't quite happen. But I ended up studying physical geography, and I just had always had a very outdoor life. I live on the edge of the Peak District National Park in the lovely Staffordshire Moorlands, so very aware of the landscape, very interested in the outdoors, and yeah, I suppose that's where it started, really, just having a lot of walks outside. And I really enjoyed studying geography because it's a really broad discipline. And I mean, I even did climate science, even though I must stress I am not a climate specialist. But it's always part of most standard geography courses. So I did quite well with it for about the first 4 weeks. And then suddenly we kind of seemed to drift into boundary level climates. And somehow it got away from me because it is quite techie, isn't it? Climate science. But yeah. So that's how I got into it. I mean, I've done many things in my career. But I would say the theme that runs through it is landscape. And I'm interested in the visual aspects of landscape, the ecology of landscapes, how landscapes work. And so I suppose from the point of view of this webcast, whatever we're doing, it's really about how climate interacts with the landscape. And climate change is a huge topic for all geographers. So I suppose that's where, you know, I come into that end of things and how I've ended up working for the Wildlife Trusts on this particular program to restore temperate rainforests.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the project that you're, the program that you're, that you're in charge of? Because it sounds really interesting. So can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So, as I say, I work for the Wildlife Trusts, and you may not know this, but the Wildlife Trusts is a slightly unique environmental NGO in the UK because we are a federated charity. So that means that we're actually made up of 47 separate charities. Now, I actually work for the Wildlife Trust, the central charity, as we're called, the hub of the wheel, if you like. But we then have 46 area-based charities. So, for example, I live in the county of Staffordshire, and I am also a member of my local wildlife trust, which is Staffordshire Wildlife Trust. But there are actually 46. We've got Scottish Wildlife Trust, we've got the Isles of Scilly, Alderney, Manx, Northern Ireland, Ulster Wildlife Trust, but most sort of counties, they're not quite counties now, but they have their own wildlife trust, but we all work together in a federation. So we've got this big connected set of charities working on wildlife conservation. But we obviously are managing a lot of habitat. And so, you know, we've been really aware about the impacts of climate change for decades because we do the practical end of things. You know, we're actually managing landscapes and trying to restore, enhance environments and habitats for species as well as for people. And weather and climate is all over that, isn't it? So we've had a long-standing interest in this, but about 3 years ago, the Wildlife Trusts were really lucky in that we were able to enter into a partnership with a large insurance company called Aviva in the UK. And Aviva have basically given us a donation, a large donation, I should say, of £38 million to undertake a project to restore and create new temperate rainforests across the UK. And so this is a really groundbreaking, I suppose, a green finance programme. And so what we're doing is we are, in essence, simply put, we're buying land and we then plant temperate rainforest on it, though there's a lot more to that than it sounds, but essentially we're planting trees on land. We then monitor how much carbon they are sequestering out of the atmosphere. So we do, and that's my role, we do carbon calculations to work out how much CO2 those trees are sucking out of the atmosphere as they grow. And that then gets validated and verified by external bodies. And essentially, we then pass these, they're called woodland carbon units. And one woodland carbon unit is the equivalent of one metric ton equivalent of CO2. And so Aviva are taking those carbon units that we've created through our activity and retiring them immediately. They're not doing anything, they're not trading them or doing anything else with them, but they are using that carbon unit to essentially help them on their net zero journey as a company. So I don't know whether you've talked about this in your podcast, but there are lots of different sorts of emissions for carbon. So you have your scope one emissions, your scope two emissions. So these are things that you do directly to impact the climate. So, you know, every time my gas central heating fires up and it is emitting CO2, those are things I'm producing and can control. But there are many emissions associated with industry, which are down their supply chains, for example. So Aviva is an international insurance company, have activity across the world. They have suppliers doing things for them. And so as a business, they are emitting a large amount of CO2, just like any big business would. They're no different from others in that. But they are taking really proactive steps now to offset the carbon that they cannot reduce themselves in time for 2040. So we're kind of part of that process, and we do need to engage with big business on this, because, you know, if we haven't got every sector of society thinking about climate change and doing their utmost to reduce our carbon emissions, we are not going to be able to control climate warming, and we are going to have runaway climate warming. You know, we're not going to hit our Paris Agreement targets, and the consequences for every single living thing on the planet if we do not do that are horrendous. You know, we can already see the impacts of climate warming. So that's the kind of technical end of it. But the exciting bit is we get to restore temperate rainforests in the UK, which is amazing.
You must have the best conversations with all of those trusts. Like, every time you guys meet up, you're going to have an expert in so many, like, different things on the environment. It must be just an amazing, you know, community of people to know. I can only imagine, it's like getting all the weather forecasters together. They all go crazy over certain things, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we're a collaboration of the passionate and excited, you know. But every single person who works for the Wildlife Trust is absolutely committed and passionate to restoring nature in the UK. You know, we have astonishing landscapes, we have wonderful species. You know, nature is amazing. And so everybody's got their own little specialism in it, haven't they? But we have to collaborate because no one person has all the knowledge. And so, you know, we've got fantastic people on the ground who are actually the people who might be planting the trees, putting the fences up, managing the land with their livestock, right through to technical experts like me who spend a lot of my time in front of a computer undertaking carbon calculations and managing that kind of technical mapping end of the process. So, yeah, it's a wonderful organisation to work for.
Some people who are listening to this podcast might be surprised to hear that there are rainforests in the UK.
I am one of them. So I know, one of them. What is a rainforest? Like, explain it all.
Yeah, I know a little bit about them, but as Ash says, like, what are they? And if we wanted to go and find a rainforest in the UK, where would we need to go to?
Oh yes, I know. Isn't it amazing that we have rainforests in the UK? Because of course, I'm sure, like most people, if we say the word rainforests, I'm sure, you know, you're immediately thinking of these incredible tropical rainforests, you know, the huge Amazon, you know, the Congo Basin, these astonishingly important biodiverse green lungs of the planet that are full of astonishing species diversity. They're hot, they're moist, they're steaming.
Got snakes.
They've got a lot of snakes.
Pythons.
Yeah, they've got a lot of biodiversity. They are the biodiversity hotspots of the world, and they are incredibly important for the planet's health. They're astonishing. But the tropical rainforest has a temperate twin. So, you know, we in the UK, your climate scientists, you know this, we live in a temperate climate. And temperate rainforests are much rarer than tropical rainforests because they need a very specific temperate climate to survive in. So, and the other thing about that is that the UK is a very important part of the biogeographic zone where that climate is found. Now, after the last ice age in the UK, which, depending on where you were, would be between 10 and 13, 14,000 years ago, we were covered in ice, certainly covered in ice where I am up in the northwest. But after that, you know, the UK's landscape was scraped clean and we started to have this warming climate after the ice had retreated. Probably, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 years after the ice retreated, the UK was covered in forest. We were, you know, we were a wooded island before humans really got to work on it, you know, and as humans made it back into the UK from mainland Europe, we obviously started to cut down that forest as settled agriculture took over. So at one point, the UK probably was cut, about 20% of the UK was covered in temperate rainforest. Okay. We now have less than 1% left. That's how little we have, which is why you've probably not heard of it. But we are a really important part of this biome. So, well, you know, this biome, we talk about the area on the planet where this climate exists. And I'll tell you where the other bits are. So we have the temperate rainforest zone. Ireland is very important. We have little bits of Brittany. We have bits of the west coast of North America, little bits down the west coast of South America as well. Japan, and that is a very important area. Little bits of places like Tasmania, New Zealand have suitable climates. It's where we have, you know, it's very latitudinally based. But yes, I mean, it was never as extensive in recent times as the tropical rainforest is currently. But certainly Northwest Europe, with our slightly miserable weather most of the time, is perfect for temperate rainforest.
I just want to know where they are. Where are they in the UK? Where can we go and visit them?
So Cornwall, most of Devon and the northern tips of Somerset are in the zone. So that's the kind of southwest zone. Most of Wales, all the western half of Wales, and Anglesey falls into the zone. The Isle of Man does as well. Then we have Cumbria. So if you think about the Lake District, bits of the Yorkshire Dales, little bits in Lancashire, some of the wetter bits of Lancashire, then all the western side of Scotland, basically. So the Western Isles and the west coast of Scotland is a really core area, but it does go all the way through up into parts of the western parts of Orkney and other areas. So Northern Ireland also has the right climate, particularly over in the western part of the province. And yeah, so it's that western side where we have wetter, cooler, oceanic climate.
If I was just like walking in a forest, the chances are, if I was up in the west of Ireland, I'm walking in a forest, the chances are it's a temperate rainforest.
Well, it might be. It's not just the climate. They are very specialised habitats. So a temperate rainforest, when you walk into them, they have a very special atmosphere. They are defined by the fact that not only are they climatically defined, but they are very moist, dripping. They have a lot of moss. So all the trees will be covered in moss. They'll have lichens hanging from the branches. The forest floor will be covered in ferns. It'll feel moist. It'll feel cool. And they're also characterized by epiphytes. So epiphytes are plants that grow on other plants. So if you can imagine a big oak tree, you imagine a nice big limb of an oak tree stretching out in a temperate rainforest that will be covered in moss, and it'll have ferns, it might have rowan trees, it'll have bilberry, it'll have a whole habitat on its trunk growing out of the trunk because it's so wet and there's enough water held within the canopy. And so they're very particular places. And so not every forest is a temperate rainforest. So they are deciduous. That's the other thing I should say in most of the UK, though some of the Scottish ones will have some Scots pine in them, but they'll have trees like oaks. They'll have a lot of hazel. They'll have rowans, which are the ones that get the lovely red berries on, mountain ash trees, some people call them. Lots of diversity. They are one of our most diverse ecosystems.
I'm just wondering if I've ever been in one and I didn't know.
You might have been. You may well have been. I mean, the most famous ones in the west of England are the Dart Valley and Wissmans Wood, which is very famous on Dartmoor. It's this tiny little fragment of it, which is kind of mystic and very small, but that's very famous. But there are many. If you go onto the Wildlife Trust website and type in temperate rainforests, it'll bring up all of our nature reserves that you can go and visit. And likewise, if you go to some of our partners, like the Woodland Trust, also own many temperate rainforests, as does the National Trust. So they are, once you start looking for them, you can find them. But the reason they exist, okay, just to float your boat. Okay, so they need a minimum of 1400 millimetres of rain per annum. So quite
Ooh,
wet.
That's quite wet. Yeah.
And they're frequently in areas over 2000 millimetres. So, you know, they thrive the more rain there is, frankly.
So for those that don't know anything about rainfall, I have a little rainfall distribution map in my brain from when I first moved here. But, you know, southeast of England, about 600 mil. It's actually really dry spark, like Edinburgh is only 800 mil, but there are little hotspots. That might make sense then, doesn't it? Around Dartmoor, just the top of them, yeah, there, where you'd have over 1,200.
Snowdonia, for example, is a classically wet place in Britain, isn't it? And it has lots of temperate rainforest fragments. But the key thing about it isn't just about the total amount of rainfall, okay? It's actually really important that rainfall is consistent throughout the year. Okay, so we're not talking a very continental climate where you have a lot of rain in the winter and it's dry and cold, or, you know, very dry and warm in the summer. We need to have at least 10% of the annual rainfall falling in the months of July and August. So we can't, the temperate rainforests can't cope with summer drought. They need steady drizzle. They love a steady drizzle, deer rainforests, but they need it cool. They can't cope with extreme temperatures. So they need nothing extreme. They also can't cope with extreme cold. So they really need their mean winter temperature to be at over 2 degrees C. So that's why you won't get temperate rainforests up in Scotland, up in the Cairngorms, for example, because it's too cold. They need to be on the west coast of the UK because they're getting that oceanic influence from the sea. So it's not cold, it's not too cold, it's wet. Drizzle is what they love. They like a light drizzle all year round, basically.
It's like thinking about this weather so far this year, it's been really dry through spring and summer. So like, it's a if you guys have got a grant for 38 million, it's a real challenge to keep those forests alive.
It certainly is, yeah. And climate change is something that we are actively considering in how we do this. So we've got those kind of macroclimatic ranges, and they are just ranges, okay? They are kind of, this is where they tend to occur, all right? But it isn't a hard and fast thing. You know, there's not like a line drawn across the landscape, you know, going, right, this side's okay, that side, no. It's much more nuanced than that because they respond very much to the microclimate of a landscape. So they particularly thrive in gorges. So if you can imagine a sort of tight rocky gorge, maybe with a nice mountain stream running through it, particularly one that is north facing. So the aspect means that it's very shaded. Now, you know, even if there's no trees and you walk down into a gorge like that, the shade will have lowered the average temperature, sometimes by quite a number of degrees. And so they tend to like clinging to damp, shady, cool gorges. Okay, so microclimate on that local scale is also really important in their survival. Okay, so you might have areas where you might think, oh, well, maybe this looks like it should be perhaps a little bit too warm for these, but then you'll find the actual landscape actually has got components in it that mitigate some of those slightly, you know, more extreme things. So at a local scale, the microclimate is really, really important. Also, once you've got closed canopy in a temperate rainforest, so when we talk about closed canopy, that means the trees have grown sufficiently that, you know, there's not like a lot of sky. There are open bits to it, but you know, if you look up, you see trees really, and of course that has a shading effect, and that also lowers the temperature under the canopy. I mean, I'm sure you've done things on trees and how they reduce heat in cities and how amazing they are at shading. Well, they have a microclimate of their own, temperate rainforests do. So once you have them, they tend to keep the landscape underneath them cooler. But what we're trying to do is plant new ones. And so you made a very pertinent point actually about how we're keeping them alive. Well, when we start to think about what we're going to plant, we use a model which we can include the climate warming scenarios for the next 2050, you know, up to 2050 or 2080. So we use the UK Met Office climate scenarios, and we can use those to give us a species mix that is going to cope with the predicted warming for that location. And so that is very important. So we're trying to mitigate that climate warming a bit by the species we're planting, but we also need to look after the trees very carefully when we plant them, for certainly until they're well established. And certainly if we have severe drought just after we planted them, we may well lose them and have to go and replant. So it's a very pertinent issue to us, how to keep the trees alive long enough that they can start shading and creating their own microclimate.
Brings watering your garden to a whole new level.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we are planting probably over the course of the programme, we're going to be planting a million trees. So, no, you can't go around sampling with your watering can. You have to plant in a robust way, I suppose. But yes, you do lose trees when you plant them anyway, naturally.
If we stay on the topic of climate change as well, so how do temperate rainforests, but rainforests in general, how do they help us combat some of the impacts from climate change? But then also, how are they going to be impacted by climate change?
Okay, so I mean, that's a great question. So they are carbon dense. So if you have a mature temperate rainforest, you know, one that's been there for hundreds of years, you've got a very diverse habitat. You've got a lot of very carbon dense, slow growing deciduous trees like oak trees or the classic one, which have a very long, slow carbon sequestration. So they grow slowly, but they grow over hundreds of years. And as they grow, they are pulling carbon dioxide out and they are storing that as carbon and biomass in their trunks, but they also have huge root networks. And so much of the carbon dioxide that is stored in a temperate rainforest is actually locked away in the soil, and the roots and all of the fungi and all of the mosses and all of the lichens that are absolutely carpeting them. You know, these are not plantation forests, so they're not like walking into a forestry commission Sitka spruce plantation. I'm sure you've done it, where you've got huge stands of conifers and they're in rows and there's not a thing alive underneath them. Not like that at all. A temperate rainforest is just brim packed with life. So that means there's lots of carbon being stored already in them, and they are still sucking that carbon dioxide out of the air for us. So they are fulfilling that anyway, but we, in planting them, we obviously are extending the woodland coverage in the UK and pulling more carbon out of the atmosphere. So they are currently doing that. They do have that cooling effect in a landscape anyway. So where you have those fragments of nice deciduous, well, it's the same for any deciduous forest actually, but where you have them as temperate rainforest and they're in these lovely gorges and things, they are perpetuating that cooling of that local landscape. So they are actually like climate refuges in some respects, and they'll become increasingly important actually as cooler spaces in the landscape for all sorts of species, including us actually. And you know, the fact that they keep the humidity up as well, that benefits lots of other species as well. So you know, they fulfill lots of issues. They're fulfilling a really important climate role already. But the more we plant, obviously, you know, we need a lot. It's tree planting is not going to solve climate change. You know, we need many other things. They're just part of the solution. But with a warming climate, all forests are threatened, actually. So, I mean, many concerns are to do with increased risk of forest fire. Okay, which I'm sure, you know, you've seen that perhaps around where you live. I don't know where you're based, but I mean, I live on the edge of the Peak District here, and we've already had quite serious uncontrolled fires up on the moorlands. Accidental starts, people start them deliberately. They can be devastating, you know, releasing huge amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. So we know that we've got increasing risks of fire. Okay, but a temperate rainforest is wet. So you can imagine, I mean, you know, it's like trying to light a wet cloth. You know, it doesn't burn very easily. So the wetter we can make any of our forests, the better that is, in terms of them not being so at risk from that climate risk of forest fire. Yeah, but there are many threats. And, you know, there's other threats to all our forests from disease. You know, as the climate warms, we've got diseases that are spreading in from Europe and being brought in from all over the planet, actually, through, you know, shipping and, you know, trade, that we have to keep a really close eye on. And we don't know what some of those diseases might be as the climate warms. We don't know how our trees are going to be affected by that. But the thing about a deciduous temperate rainforest is they're very diverse. So that's nature's way of building in resilience. the more diverse it is, the less risk there is of a complete wipeout of your forest with one disease. So, yeah, diversity breeds strength.
They sound amazing. Like, I mean, I'm going to... Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've been to one in Devon, but I'm going to put it on my list to go. Is it true that trees communicate via their root system?
It is. It is. I mean, it's been termed the, let me think, what was it? The wood wide web. The wood wide web. Now, I'm not an expert in mycorrhizal fungi, which is what you're talking about. So there'll be other people listening to your podcast who are. So I'll just give you the basics. But this is the idea that in a woodland, a mature woodland, trees, as I said to you before, you know, they've got huge root systems. And a good way of thinking about a big deciduous tree, if you imagine perhaps your favourite tree in your park, you know, if you imagine the shape of it sitting there, well, the roots will be as big as that under the ground and in a similar shape, sort of. You know, this is as much or often underground as there is above. So there's this incredible load of stuff underground. And part of that is that every tree will have associated fungi and mycorrhizal networks. And these are complex. They're very connected into the roots. They help the roots actually feed. They work in symbiosis with the trees to actually get nutrients out of the soil into the trees. And the trees connect through these. And you know, people listen to these now with bioacoustics. You can listen to the trees talking to each other. And people have demonstrated that that trees will share resources between them and that they can send out distress signals through the mycorrhizal network. And it's an absolutely fascinating area of research. So you're absolutely right. They do talk to each other.
I really want to hear them talking to each other now. Like, that would be... Like, I can't even imagine what the sound would be like, but that would be fascinating to hear how they're communicating.
Now, I'm sure you can find somebody who could play you some recordings. You'll find some online, I'm sure.
Nature is astonishing how great it is. It's amazing.
I have a question for you about the amount of trees being planted. So I think you said 1 million was the target.
Roughly. It depends.
Target, you know, yeah.
It's a lot of trees.
So I'm just thinking about in an average storm in the UK, how many trees can come down. And it can be more than 1 million. Like, how long does it take to put these trees in? And, you know, like how many would you ideally like to be planting?
Well, I mean, you can only, you have to plant a sensible number, you know, for a size. So, you know, typically in a hectare, a commercial plantation might plant very densely, say at 1.5 metre spacing. You know, I'm sure you can imagine those commercial plantations. The trees are packed in for good reason. And, you know, there'll be thousands of trees per hectare. We tend to plant at between 2.5 metre spacing and 5 metre spacing. So to give you an idea, if you plant something at 5 metre average spacing in a hectare, that's 400 stems, we call them, but little saplings per hectare. Okay, so I remember a hectare is 100 by 100 meters square, effectively, and a kilometer square is 100 hectares. But it quickly goes up. So I'm trying to think, is 2 meters 1600 per hectare? I'd have to just double check, or 2.5 is 1100 if I've got my numbers right. So it depends on the species. Now, we, like I say, because we're planting deciduous trees and we're planting for biodiversity and we're planting for nature recovery, we're not doing it at commercial stocking rates. It makes no sense. And also, deciduous trees behave differently. So they need a bit more room. There is some benefit to planting very densely, particularly in the early stages. But when you say, yeah, in a bad storm, 1 million trees can come down, most of those will be conifers in Sitka spruce plantations. And they get something called windthrow, you know, and you'll see that on the edges of plantations where a storm hits, like Storm Dara, you know, in January, hits into the edge of those exposed plantations, and you get this domino effect, and you can just get them snapped off. at kind of 5 meter high, 2, 3, 4, 5 meter height, and you can get thousands and thousands of trees just snapped off in a single plantation by one storm. Temperate rainforests are not a risk like that because they're very diverse, and deciduous trees grow much slower, so they've got much deeper roots. You know, they are much better at resisting that type of storm event. And, you know, each individual tree is going to grow into something much bigger with much more carbon. So it's like comparing apples and pears a bit, if you see what I mean. When we plant a single lovely oak sapling, it becomes so much more than just a single conifer, if you see what I mean. They're not really equivalent in terms of carbon storage or biomass or how they grow.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Really, really interesting. I'm actually just like, when you were saying that, please don't judge me, but a deciduous tree is one that sheds its leaves, right?
That's right, yes.
In the winter, yeah.
So your conifer tree are the pine trees that keep them all year round, the evergreens. So those are the commercial plantations. Those are all non-native species. They're all imported from places like Norway and Canada because they grow very effectively in our wet climates. They're called softwood. You might have heard them called softwood. And they're very important because we make paper out of them. You know, they are a very important crop for the UK. So we're not saying that we don't need conifer plantations, because we do. They are an important part of our resources. But they're a different thing. They're a short term. You need to think of them as a crop. OK, they are planted to be felled. You know, they are. And we want to maximise the amount of stuff we get off them quickly. But because they grow quickly, they're not very dense. So you don't build, you didn't build ships out of softwood. You built them out of oak when we used to build ships purely out of wood, because it's harder and it's stronger. And that's because it grows so much more slowly. So it just, the structure of the tree is just completely different. So we do need deciduous trees, but they do, because of our season, you know, our latitude and our climate, they are designed to shed all their leaves in the autumn, and they basically go slightly dormant until the sun arrives again in early spring, and then off they go like crazy.
I'm feeling like I know just about enough now that I could sneak into one of your dinner parties with all of your very lovely geographer friends and people who know all of this stuff about nature, and I could nod along and be like, aha!
No, yeah, I know we've got temperate rainforests.
Yeah, exactly.
And they are really special and unique. And they're all over in the West.
Brilliant.
And they're climatically defined.
That's really interesting. I'm going to ask that question next time we get a storm coming through. You know, where do the trees actually come down? It's really interesting just to know that, and to know that they can actually. So although it's devastating that they come down, they can be replenished.
And also in a native woodland, it's normal for trees to be, you know, it's part of the ecology. And we do need that to happen occasionally, because it then forms deadwood, we call it. It, you know, all the fallen branches, a tree gets uprooted, say it's a big beech tree, you know, 120 years old. It's very sad to lose it, you know, but I'm sure you've seen it in woods where the tree's been ripped up and it's still kind of attached down here, and you can see the root plate and the trees laid out along the forest floor. That in itself is fantastically interesting habitat. All sorts of stuff love that. And if the tree is left, it will slowly decompose into the ecosystem of the forest. So that carbon actually then gets broken down into the soil and can be reused by the trees. But the critical thing is you get an opening in the canopy. And that is very important, because the forests then regenerate. You get a sudden flush of growth because everything goes, yay, blue sky, sunshine, woof, and off they go. And the place gets full of saplings growing up like crazy. So it's normal. We need that in forests. You know, they really do need a bit of deadwood. So an odd tree coming over is just normal in a woodland. And, you know, it's sad, but it happens. But in a deciduous woodland, if you can imagine, they're more woolly. I always describe it as woolly. If you've seen like footage of the UK where somebody's flying around in a plane, and you're looking down from a plane, you know, if you look over a nice a nice deciduous woodland in the UK, it's all kind of nicely lumpy, isn't it? Like a woolly jumper, and it's all
cauliflower broccoli or something.
Cauliflower broccoli, perfect description. And that gives it huge surface roughness. And so, again, you two will know much more about this than me, but airflow hitting something very rough like that, and a woodland that has got openness in it and it can move through, will behave very differently than airflow that hits a monoculture stand of conifers, if you can imagine. It's much more of a smack, isn't it, rather than a, oh, I can go through that. So again, just the structure of a temperate rainforest makes it much less at risk. And again, and it's also often down in the gorges, so it likes shelter.
I love how you're trusting our knowledge there. You're giving us a lot of credit throughout this podcast.
I know. In my mind, you two are weather experts, so I'm quite sure you do know quite a lot about
it. I can visualise it. I was visualising the air and everything, so I was, but I had never thought of it necessarily in that way. But I was like, oh yeah, of course, it makes sense that the air can go through the trees, and yeah.
So they are less at risk. I mean, I suppose, you know, when we get those big storms, what we often see is like the devastation potentially, say in your local park, you know, where a beautiful huge tree is, and sometimes you might get a couple of them ripped out. It's because they're vulnerable. They're out in the open. That isn't how they would grow. You know, that is their sort of non-natural way of growing. They would be in a wood, you know, surrounded by their mates and their offspring and other people. So it would be rarer. But in woods themselves, it's not as common to see a deciduous wood, you know, lose a big stack of trees in one storm event. They'll lose odd ones, and they can be very damaging.
At some point last year, I read a book called How to Read Trees. I can't remember who it was by. And the same author wrote How to Read Rivers or How to Read Water as well. But it was fascinating how he was describing how you can, so you would obviously probably know somebody who can do this, but just reading the landscape by where, like if you have an isolated tree, the chances of it being there from somebody either planting it or naturally happening, and understanding how you can tell about where riverways used to be, and whether it was, you can immediately tell whether somebody has been living there from the types of trees that ended up there. The whole thing was fascinating, and I wish I could remember more about it. I should probably go reread the book, but maybe it make a bit more sense now that after talking to you, you know.
I mean, if we've got loads of kind of indicators where ancient woodlands used to be in this landscape, and one that's quite common that you will see about is sometimes on hillsides you'll see patches of bracken. And sometimes they've got bluebells in them even. Well, that in itself is an indication that there was actually, it was originally wooded. And, you know, often if you get very, very botanically rich hedgerows, some of the species that are grown in them, they are little remnants of woodland. And certainly, I suppose the thing about a big deciduous tree, I mean, we have the oldest oak trees in Europe. We are the home of veteran trees in the UK. We've got some of the most important trees in terms of age. You know, some of them are 800-900 years old. And there's a famous park, Moccas Park in Herefordshire. And we've got this huge concentration of incredibly veteran trees. Now, think about history. What is 800 years that tree has been there? You know, and all this stuff that's been going on around it, things coming, you know, woodlands coming up around it, being removed, agriculture changing, roads being built. It's just sitting there carrying on growing, doing its thing. And, you know, just understanding that how you see it now is not how it would have been. It's perhaps a very recent landscape. That tree is perhaps looking at it thinking, I've got another 200 years.
Young little toddlers. Yeah. I think we're going to have to move on. The time is flying by here. We would like to get to know a little bit more about you. Gemma, do you want to take it away with our get to know me round?
Yeah, so this is just a really quick round that's got a few random questions in it. So we always start by asking, what is your favourite season?
My favourite season is autumn.
Controversial. Only because I love spring. No, for me, it's controversial. There's a lot of autumn lovers on the podcast, and I'm always like, no, spring is the best. Why is autumn your favourite season?
But no, if you ask me to pick one, it's autumn, definitely. I love autumn.
Is that to do with the colours?
I think it just epitomises our temperate seasonal climate, doesn't it? Because we forget, because we live here, that it's quite a rare climate on a global context. And most people don't get four seasons in a year. Many people have two rainy seasons, or they might have two very distinct seasons and then two tiny little autumns and springs which don't mean anything. And I just love that kind of lengthening of the days and the light in the northern hemisphere in the autumn, those golden, for me, a frosty blue clear day in the autumn when the leaves have turned is just beautiful, rich, full of berries. Yeah.
It is lovely. Autumn is an amazing season. If you had to choose between the beach or the mountains, where would you prefer to go?
Mountains every time.
Well, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? After the podcast, I'm like, okay, we're probably.
And I mean, you know, partly because I have classic kind of Celtic skin, you know, very pale and freckly. I don't do well in the sun. I am designed for the northern hemisphere, very much so. I love walking. I really like being up in the mountains.
There's so much peace being up in the mountains. It's just amazing. Yeah. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
What, apart from stopping climate change and all of those things? Okay, a superpower. I think I'd like to be able to fly. Being able to fly like a bird, that just must be amazing. Oh, yeah, to be able to fly, I think.
We've had a few people say that recently, actually, that they wish that they were able to fly.
Every time somebody suggests a superpower, I'm like, oh, no, actually, I want that. No, I want to fly. No, I want to talk to animals. No, I want to be able to breathe underwater. No, I want to be able to, you know, apparate somewhere. Yeah. I want it all.
Yeah.
And if you were a fruit or vegetable, what would you be?
Oh, my goodness. What would I like to be, or what do I think I'm probably most like?
You can say do both.
Whatever you're feeling.
What would I most want to be? I think probably a really good, nice English variety apple. Yeah, because they take a long time to grow. They're at their best in the autumn. Nothing can beat it in season. You can make alcohol out of it. You can make crumble. You can eat them. Yeah, they're good for you. Yeah, no, maybe an apple if I had to be a fruit.
This is like a new fresh look on the humble apple. I like it.
If you could invite one person to dinner, it can be anybody at all from any historical time frame or even a fictional character. Who would it be?
Oh, who would it be? That's really a good one, isn't it? Oh, I wish you'd given me these in advance so I could have thought about it.
No, we like people to come up with them on the spot, you know, because then you...
Can be living or dead, did you say?
Yeah.
Fictional, otherwise...
Oh. I think maybe somebody like Rosalind Franklin, who discovered the DNA helix thingy. I'd really like to ask her about how annoyed she was about not being recognised.
Add her to a long list of females.
Yeah, no, science, but just because her interesting take on research and just talking to a female researcher from the 50s, because I have a scientific background and I did work at Cambridge University for a bit, and just it would be very interesting to hear about how she felt about discovering that absolutely critical piece of knowledge. I mean, DNA, you know, and she was the one. Yeah, that double helix on that photograph. Yeah. Yeah. If nothing else, I mean, you know, even if she was very dull, I'd like to shake her hand and say, well done.
Yeah, thank you.
Ta.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen the, I read Lessons in Chemistry. Have you?
No.
I see it's on the telly as well. It's called Lessons in Chemistry. It's basically about this really like brilliant female scientist, and she falls in love with the male scientist, but it's about her experience in science back in the 50s. It's brilliant. I'd highly recommend I read the book, so I kind of have a different thing in my head. You know, sometimes they kind of sit slightly different on telly, but I would definitely recommend it. I feel like you'd enjoy it.
Oh, okay.
I could tell how similar mine and Ash's brains are, because I was thinking exactly the same thing as you were talking. I was like, you need to read or watch Lessons in Chemistry, so I could tell how similar our brains are.
Down.
Do write it down. That's because me and Gemma talk about 50 times a day on voice notes over different things.
Okay.
And the final question that we all always ask everyone on the podcast is, what's one thing that you wish everybody knew about temperate rainforests?
That we have them in the UK and they're ours on special and we need to look after them.
That's a great message. Love
it. Perfect. Perfect. Thank you so, so much for joining us today. We've really enjoyed this last hour. I have yet again had another hour. I've just learned so much stuff and certainly given me more food for more questions. So, you know, I think the next time something happens with trees, I'll have more of an idea of of what to ask. We just, you know, that's what we love doing this podcast. We always take some really brilliant stuff away from it. So
well,
let's
say,
so
you know, look on the website, the Wildlife Trust website, type in temperate rainforests. You'll find out all about our rainforest research program, sites you can visit, and we don't charge for you to go. You know, you don't have to be a member to go and visit our Wildlife Trust sites, but we'd really encourage everybody to join their local Wildlife Trust so that we can carry on looking after these places for everybody to enjoy.
You should definitely go and check them out. I've been to a few of my local nature reserves and they're beautiful, and you should go to your local nature reserve, try and find your local temperate rainforest, put your headphones in, maybe listen to the podcast, but also just disconnect and listen to the sounds of nature, really connect with nature and take in what you're seeing around you. So yeah, definitely go and check out your local nature reserve.
And Ruth, where can we find you? If somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to contact you?
You can find me through the Wildlife Trust's website. I am on LinkedIn. If you look for Dr. Ruth Swetnam, there's only one of me, so you will find me. So yeah, sure.
If you have enjoyed this episode, we would love it if you would subscribe, rate and review and share the podcast with a friend. If you would like to follow us on social media, we are For the Love of Weather. And we just hope that you leave this episode loving the weather just that little bit more.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening.